Welcome to Legal News and Review, recipient of the Florida Bar Award of Excellence. Legal News and Review, the only real problem solver radio program using the law, with your moderator, Philip Bell, and hosts and legal panel attorney, Gary Singer, chair of the Broward County Bar Association's Real Property Section. Gary Singer is board certified in real estate law and a syndicated columnist from the Sun Sentinel. He is an expert in his field of practice. Now, here's your moderator, Philip Bell.
On the docket for today's program, this month a passenger sues a cruise line after a bungee accident. He's suing Royal Caribbean after sustaining injuries on what is called a sky pad, a bungee ride, during the cruise. It's all fun till someone gets hurt. Today, from Bray Law Firm, is founder Keith Bray. Keith is a maritime board-certified attorney, and that makes him an expert in the area of maritime and admiralty law. Keith will be giving us the 411 on passengers, but also cruise rights, such as the Jones Act. You got to understand what that actually is. But first, I'd like to welcome and introduce the legal panel for today. Gary Singer, good afternoon.
Hey, first thing, like with the Jones Act, there should be a law that if you have a law named after you, you need a less generic name. Just saying.
Gary, you used to be in the Coast Guard.
I used to be in the Coast Guard. Once a coastie, always a coastie. I was the coastie with the mostie.
Yeah.
Not in the Navy.
Used to shoot those 50-millimeter guns.
I were no squid. Are you kidding me? I was in the Coast Guard. I used to go to happy hour.
Eric Yankowit, welcome and good afternoon.
It's true.
I know.
Eric Yankowit. You got the Eric down. Be happy. Thank God for small favors. He could have called you George or something.
Yankowit. I couldn't resist.
I'm gonna get a law named after me, and then he'll pronounce
it. If it makes you feel any, he calls me Gary with two R's.
Hey, so the kids at Nova could do a shot. Okay, it's a game. Also, Eric, as my personal attorney, thank you for your help during this tax time because you're also my accountant.
Yeah, see how it's going to go now after you screwed his name up for show.
I know. Obviously, yeah, I can't wait to see that.
And thanks for staying in trouble so I can earn my fee.
Meanwhile, back at the market, good afternoon and welcome to our listeners in Florida on 96.9 FM, 103.9 FM at 7:40 a.m. Listening to our broadcast in the beginning of drive time, and let's not forget the national listeners on iHeart, TuneIn, and iRadio Now. I think I should also add international because I get emails from South America, Belize, and things like that from people catching it.
Are they telling you won the lottery?
No, they're not telling me I won the lottery, but they find the show very informative because they don't understand the workings here in the United States of the law.
Okay.
Innocent before you're proved guilty, you know, as well. I want to remind our listeners, you can actually watch the production of Legal News and Review. It's simple. Just Google Legal News and Review Facebook. We come right up. You could even see past episodes. Today, we're recording at the Kelly Ustahl Building in their very own mock courtroom. You talk about resources. If you've been severely injured from the negligence of someone else, just go to Justice for All. That's justiceforall.com. Keith Bray, welcome to Legal News and Review.
Hi, Phil. Nice to be here. Thanks for having me.
Appreciate you taking the time.
So you got Keith's name right, but you messed up Yankowit?
Well, it's easy to do that. I've known him for years.
I want to know, how can you be negligent for allowing someone to jump off a ledge on a bungee cord? Like, all kidding aside, you would think like there would be some sort of exception for that. You're jumping off something tied to a rubber band.
And don't they make them sign something anyway?
Yeah, isn't that like an assumption of something or another?
Yeah. So,
let's talk
about
this.
There's three questions there.
Yeah.
I happened to look at the newscast. It's being handled by an attorney in Miami.
Mm-hmm.
And there was a video clip. So apparently a family member who was videoing this process of what happened. And he's bungeeing up and down inside a big round ball, if you will, with basically trampolines below. And if you look at the video, it appears that the anchor cables that were fastened above him let go.
Oh, okay.
Oh, my God.
So not quite, falling off and not really. I mean, I think you go on. It's supposed to go on there and jump up and down, but you're not expecting the support
to
bungees
fall, right,
to let go and suddenly fall to the floor.
Well, as I said, it's all fun until someone gets hurt. I recently was on a cruise a couple months ago with one of the largest ships in the world. Great time. And I went down the slide. And I didn't know where it ended up. I thought it was just ending up somewhere else. But no, it's one of those slides that you go into this thing that looks like a toilet, kind of. You go round and round.
Wait, did you get stuck?
No, I didn't. Oh. But and then you, then you go
hilarious.
Down the center.
You know, I caught him drinking out of my toilet last week after a party.
All right. But in all seriousness, I did hurt my back. I was not prepared for that as well. But it did, you know, took some aspirin. It did went away. It did not ruin my trip. But I could see how people, you know, have a false sense of security.
That's cold beer.
Well, that's true, too. My God. I've never seen so much drinking until I went on a cruise in my entire life, and I've been in college.
So you actually bring up two points and to follow up on Gary's point.
Woohoo!
Yeah.
Is there something called assumption of the risk? I mean, you decided to go on that ride. You were thinking you were going to have a great time and all the rest of it. Maritime law doesn't really recognize assumption of the risk. It recognizes comparative fault. So if there were a situation where you contributed to your injury, it wouldn't really be the case, well, you get nothing because you decided to participate. It would be a situation more like, well, what degree of fault did you have? And then, you know, Eric mentioned something which is probably applicable, having to do with this, don't they make you sign something, I think was the comment.
Right.
So cruise lines, there's actually a federal statute that says, because cruise lines are common carriers,
right,
they can't absolve themselves of the duties and responsibilities of reasonable care they owe to you. So
well, that's good.
Shoreside, you know, when you bungee off of Miami Beach and they want you to sign a form, they can make you sign away your rights, assuming the wording's proper. On board a cruise ship, they can't exculpate themselves from their duty of care to you.
Can't sign your life away.
Correct. Very, very different if you happen to walk off the ship and partake in an excursion. But on the ship, they can't do it.
Really? So what if it's a ship excursion, like ship sponsor excursion?
Yeah, well, so
I love cruising, so I need to know this.
You know, and part of a big attraction of the cruise lines now is that they heavily go to their website, and for every single port, they've got, 10, 15 of these different excursions. Of course, you've never been there. You don't know who the good excursion companies are. You have to rely upon the cruise lines to pick a good excursion company for you. But in the fine print on your terms and conditions, they've got a clause in there that says those excursion companies are independent contractors. And so even though they advertised them, even though the cruise line collected the money.
Right.
And obviously, you know, there was a division of the money between the excursion company and the cruise line. They're going to turn around and say, listen, if you got hurt, it's an independent contractor and you're not going to be able to bring a claim against the cruise line. There are exceptions. If the cruise line either knew or should have known that there had been people hurt, maybe on a zip line earlier, and there's been a bunch of people, then the cruise line probably should have warned you or stop doing business with them to protect the next passenger.
So what's their liability? Like I heard recently they stopped going to one port after, women were getting accosted and
assaulted
whatnot.
And stuff.
Yeah. So what's they have liability with that for going to a port where they know there's issues, for example?
Yeah, it's a really famous case. It's Carlisle. The case is called Carlisle. And the cruise line, you know, on board the ship, that's their property, so they have the duty of reasonable care with respect to making the place safe and to warn. Of non-obvious. As soon as you walk off the ship, the duty gets whittled down to one, which is the duty to warn. So if they've been there 10 or 20 times and a certain number of passengers have been sexually assaulted and, you know, they can't go to the market or they can't go anywhere without this potential risk of harm of being either assaulted or robbed or something, the cruise lines will owe a duty to warn you. Because obviously the cruise line hears about it.
Is it a degree thing? Like they have to put up banners, red neon sign or a pamphlet?
Maritime law says they have to warn you reasonably.
I see.
So it's sort of an objective standard. If everybody sitting here says that's a sufficient warning, then that's going to be deemed a sufficient warning. If it's some fine print somewhere or, you know, they've said it over the PA one time, maybe that's not going to be sufficient. The real prudent thing would be to do what was suggested was, in certain cases, just go to another port. But that might be costly.
Right.
You know, there's a bunch of business excursion companies that the cruise lines have business with. And so that's
and they own some of that interest in that excursion or that.
Well, you'd have a hard time getting a corporate representative from a cruise line to admit to that. But the truth is they own a significant portion of the profits derived because they keep that.
Now, your board's certified, and that's board certified in maritime law. And that makes you an expert. And by the way, there's only 60 in my last research. We have one of them right here. That's a good thing for our program. But can any lawyer handle this type of cases?
The horrible answer is that, yes, I suppose any lawyer could handle it. Mm-hmm. It would be a really, really horrible idea for any lawyer to try to handle a maritime case if they really, really don't have experience.
Right.
I mean, just like going to an attorney who specializes in medical malpractice, you really want to find somebody who does that, or a real estate attorney for closing.
I gave a seminar that was titled, How Not to Let the Divorce Attorney Help Their Way Out of Your Closing.
No. And, you know, there's a bunch of cases out there, and all they have these unique words. Some courts call maritime law esoteric, and some call them draconian. So if you make a mistake as an attorney representing someone in a maritime claim, and just because you weren't familiar with it,
right,
it's really just going to hurt them. And it's going to turn into a claim. You know, the plaintiff might lose their lawsuit because they didn't file in time. Cruise tickets say 1 year.
That's right.
But what ends up happening, and I probably get 3 calls a year about this, is the attorney says, what was I supposed to do, and what's this 1 year thing?
Boy.
I missed it. Well, it turns into a claim against the lawyer.
Yeah.
Right.
So why is maritime law so old school? Is it because it touches other countries and treaties
and such?
It's old rules. Yeah, old rule, old school.
I mean, it dates back hundreds of years.
But all law does. But why?
Just real quick, do you know why the captain goes down with the ship? Seriously, do you know why? I'll tell you why. Because back then, they were in charge and responsible for not only ship, but the cargo. And so if it sunk, they would be thrown into debtor's prison. And nobody wants to go in debtor's prison 200 years ago. But anyway, I found that interesting.
Really, that was worth interrupting me for?
Seriously? Your wife told me
English
I could do it.
Common law, dating back, you know, even before America, English common law, a great deal of our law, maritime law, comes from English common law.
And civil law.
So it goes way, way back.
And so it just hasn't kept up or changed as quickly as the other areas of civil law?
No, you know, it has. I mean, now, you know, as we do things here in the U.S., Congress has enacted certain statutes, but in maritime law, there's something called general maritime law. That's just a fancy way of saying common law is going to apply, and common law is just what a court said before.
Gotcha.
And it's not going to be a statute. Now, there are certain things like certain statutes that have been enacted involving the one-year statute, involving cruise passengers, involving
the Jones
DOSHA.
Act.
Jones Act.
What is the Jones Act?
Well, it used to be called the Merchant Marine Act of 1920. Is that correct?
That's right.
I've been doing my research.
Somebody's live in the present, Phil. That's twice. It's two.
But go ahead. Explain.
So the Jones Act was enacted to protect seamen subject to the perils of working on the ocean.
Eric, I'm very proud of you.
Yeah.
For the seamen?
Say anything. Good work.
Just saying.
And the reason is because, you know, if you're hurt shoreside, well, you've got Florida workers' comp and your medical bills are going to get paid for. You're going to receive a substitute wage while the period of you're being convalescing or sick. Okay, a Jones Act seaman used to get zero. And then they enacted the Jones Act statute. And the Jones Act statute gave them comparable ways of paying their bills in the meantime, something called maintenance and cure.
That's what I wanted to ask you about.
And sick wages and things like that so that the crew member doesn't starve out during the period that he's trying to bring a claim, which used to be a famous tactic, because if you didn't have any money to pay for the food and for your wife and your housing and your children, you'll settle cheap. So they tried to give them some rights and remedies so that they could at least see their day in court.
So a good percentage of my clients, my accounting clients, they live and work on those mega yachts, personal vessels, and they live like kings. They work like dogs and they live like kings, but they're living at such high volumes. I mean, they live on that yacht. Do they get a higher standard of living for maintenance and cure?
So maintenance is the per diem cost of your, quotes, in-kind living. So if you happen to be on a mega yacht and you happen to be living high on a mega yacht, then the weight or the money that will be paid to you during your convalescence, the maintenance, will probably be higher. And they'll also look to your living standards and what house you have and what's it cost for toothpaste and what's it cost for your electricity and, you know, all those things. They'll look at that and they'll come up with a daily rate. Daily rates, you know, typically for the yacht crew, I know that's a big business here, a lot of yachties here in Florida.
Multi-billion-dollar industry.
You know, it's going to be between $52 per day and could even be over $100 per day, depending upon what the in-kind services would be in substitution.
That's not a ton of money. It's not.
Let me give Eric a gift really quick. So when I was 19, I actually was promoted to seaman.
That was a little gift.
A little drum roll, but
true. I went from seaman apprentice to seaman.
Jones, and by the way, you're speaking to a former merchant marine here.
Yeah, I was very close to being a merchant marine, and then I got promoted to petty officer. So
Jones Act benefits versus benefits under the Longshore and Harbor Workers Compensation Act.
So the Jones Act, as I mentioned, really has, in the event they get injured, they get what's called maintenance incur, which is like substitute wages. Mm-hmm. And for the payment of medical care, you need surgery that the ship owner is supposed to pay for it. The LHWCA, as it's called, for the longshoremen, mm-hmm. The first thing is they're not sailing with the ship like a Jones Act seaman is. Mm-hmm. And their benefits are going to be more akin to a workers' compensation. In other words, there's a schedule of benefits. They look at the last so many weeks. They come up with an average, and they give you substitute wages. So it's very similar to a workers' compensation in that regard. One unique thing about longshoremen's claims or mm-hmm. LHWCA claims is not only are they going to collect the no-fault benefits for workers' compensation, if you will, and that, but they're also going to have the right to go file a civil lawsuit against the ship owner. Say they're on their loading stores and the ship owner participates in the loading stores and they leave a hatch open. And it should have been barricaded or something. It obviously is a danger. They fall. So they actually get the best of both worlds. They get the benefits, the schedule benefits, and they can file a civil lawsuit.
Hmm. And the Jones Act itself, it has to cover navigational waters. Am I correct?
Yeah. So for a claim to be governed by maritime law, the body of water that it occurs on mm-hmm. has to be what's called navigable waters. So obviously the ocean is going to be navigable waters. The intercoastal way is going to be navigable waters. Lakes that are connected to waterways that lead to navigable waters is going to be, to the ocean is going to be covered. But interesting here in Florida is that certain portions within the Everglades.
You mean airboats?
Airboats, if they're not dammed off and if it's navigable to the ocean, the claim can be governed by maritime law.
There's a
Maritime law is incredibly interrelated with real estate law because they touch literally.
Really?
Well, think about it; they literally touch. I mean, we deal with riparian littoral rights on a regular basis. That's everything right up until it becomes navigable.
There's a host of issues with that in the high seas, as I call it. And today, you filed a case, and it's an upsetting case. Regarding this Jane Doe, 11-and-a-half-year-old girl on the cruise ship that was molested.
Oh, man, really?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Disgusting.
Very, very unfortunately, while we always try to help people, we don't want to see people come into the office who've had horrible things happen to them. We were contacted by a family, and their 11-year-old daughter was sexually assaulted by a cruise staff member who had a pass key to get in and out as he chose, saw fit, into a cabin. And, you know, unless you're dealing with a vessel where the keel's been laid, a cruise ship after 2010, mm-hmm. then there's no requirement that these doors on your cruise ship actually latch manually. So the parents did what most parents did. They approached the cabin steward and said, could you please, my daughter's going to be in the room. She's going to be sleeping. Could you clean the room later? And unfortunately, that was a bit like ringing a dinner bell for this perpetrator. And he went in not once to advance his cause. He went and she shooed him away. She's 11. What does she know? He went in a second time, a third time, and a fourth time.
Now, these are criminal charges as well, other than civil?
So depending upon the Cruise Vessel Security and Safety Act, the cruise line, depending upon the crime, mm-hmm. has to report it to the FBI, so that's going to open up a whole bailiwick of potential criminal charges that could be brought, U.S. citizens on foreign ships. That's going to be governed by that act and by the U.S. law. There's a statute run-on point. Separate and apart from the criminal aspects of it, there's going to be a civil lawsuit that the family can obviously file on behalf of the minor child.
And a lot of these criminal acts that happen on cruise ships, I imagine, happen in foreign ports, and they have different requirements for reporting, and that's why you may not know about it here in the States. Is that?
Well, if it's a ship that's departed from you from a U.S. port, or if it's a ship that hasn't departed from U.S. ports but involves a U.S. citizen, there's still there should be, under most circumstances, a reporting requirement. Attached to that complaint, we actually looked over the Department of Transportation's records. And regarding this cruise line, I don't think we need to name the cruise line right now. Regarding that particular cruise line for the last 3 years, there was 28 sexual assaults on that ship.
Wow. Wow.
There's a page there in the back.
I mean, you know, you go on a cruise for fun, and people, unfortunately, sometimes overindulge. You know, they give these drink packages, and people want to get their money worth as well.
Well, it's a big profit center for the cruise line. So
I can imagine.
It's a huge incentive to, you know, everybody have a great time and pour them back.
But we hear about people falling overboard, you know, either intentional or by accident. But a lot of times I hear that they've been drinking heavy that night. Quite frankly, they should be watching.
It's hard to conflate that, for me at least, with like the situation we were just talking about, right? You know, if you're going to get drunk, you know, 100 feet of freeboard above the water and you fall over, that's not great, but I'm not necessarily, I mean, maybe dram shop rules or something. But, you know, you're walking along, you know, playing Leonardo de whatever his name is on a cruise ship because you're faced.
Oh, the Titanic.
You know,
Gabriel, yeah.
Some of that's on you. You know, we're all, for the grown-ups, for stuff like that, we're all grown-ups.
Well, Gary represents some of the jurors that we have to try cases in front
of. No, I don't mean bad. Believe me, there's plenty I'll blame the cruise ship on if they do something wrong. You know,
that's not a criticism. That's an objective standard that you have to look to who's going to potentially look at this and say, well, how much responsibility does the person who drank it all
have? I mean, you know, just because you're on a cruise ship doesn't give you, you know, an excuse to black out and be really dumb.
There is under general maritime law, case law, if a cruise passenger appears impaired, meaning they've been over-served or whatever, there is a duty on the part of the cruise lines to try to protect them, to act on their behalf, because at that point they're probably incapacitated and they can't protect themselves. And
that
you are on
sense.
Their property. And by the way, you can't get drunk on a cruise ship unless you've been overserved. Well, guess where the alcohol came from? I mean, they're not allowing you to come back on board with a backpack full of six packs.
Yeah, a lot of people sneak booze on ships too.
They're getting better with that.
They put them in shampoo bottles. That's what my wife does.
So they do have to protect you. They actually have to bring that person back to their cabin in order to the medical facility.
And does that actually occur? I've never actually seen that. I've never been that drunk on a cruise ship, but is that something they actively do? I'm just curious.
I more often get contacted when that's not been done.
Gotcha. Of course. That makes sense. Someone called you and said, hey, they did exactly what they're supposed to. I just wanted to let you know.
Yeah. Right? I don't get those phone calls.
Well, what about simple accidents? Somebody trips and sprains their ankle, which is a damn inconvenience if you're on vacation as well. Is that even something people should consider, you know, saying, hey, you guys ruined my vacation. You left that wire out that I slipped on or whatever. Is that something that people should even consider taking?
Well, it's really going to be fact specific. If the dangerous condition or unsafe condition that caused you to trip or fall or slip or fall is a condition that was obviously created or known about by the cruise line,
right?
And if it was a non-obvious condition, I mean, if there's a puddle there, you ought to walk around it. If there's a cable across the way and you can see it, you ought to walk over it and not get tripped up. So every single trip and fall is not going to give rise to a viable liability claim. But there are instances when obviously the condition is something that's not obvious and people get hurt. So that would certainly be a viable claim.
Well, on March 3rd, 2019, which for us is actually last month, the cruise ship Norwegian Escape was hit by a strong gust of wind. An estimated of 100 knots, not knowing what 100 knots is, but maybe you could explain that, how big that is.
Fast.
But it caused the ship to tilt extremely to the port side. And water was in, up to the windows about five stories high as well. But that's an act from God. If someone is injured, I mean, how can a cruise ship protect people from that?
So if a claim like that, and we did receive phone calls, I referred those to a practitioner who really likes to handle those. You're going to look at it and you're going to find out if the cruise line should, I mean, they have every navigational and satellite system in the entire world. They ought to be able to know what kind of weather they're sailing into. And if they can avoid it, the captain's supposed to exercise reasonable care to keep the passengers out of harm's way and to try to avoid it. If it's something that was essentially unavoidable and some sort of freak of nature, then the likelihood is that the degree to, you know, a viable lawsuit may rest upon, well, you know, did something come loose and whack something over the head that shouldn't have come loose even in those conditions? So you've got to really look at those facts and circumstances. But the last thing you probably want to have happen when you're on vacation is be listing 30 degrees and be looking at the water outside the porthole.
You handle other things that are on the water, like jet ski accidents. Is that correct?
Anything. So if you go to a resort and get down in the Keys and you rent or go on a guided tour for a PWC, personal watercraft.
How would someone get a hold of you if they thought I had a claim and they wanted to discuss it with you?
So our office phone number is 305-416-2901, 305-416-2901, and we have a website.
All right, what's
that? I think you had a nifty name for
that. An interwebsite?
There you go. It's www.brais.com.
Well, fantastic. It's always nice to meet another sailor, especially one who knows as much as you do about it. I actually was penning through the complaint. That's excellent work. I'm sure you didn't need to hear me say that to know that. But thank you very much for coming on and educating us. If you do feel you had an issue, go ahead and give him a call. He obviously knows what the heck he's doing. Thank you very much, Eric. And I'm not going to say your last name, so I'm not going to get accused of being Phil.
Yankwin.
And Phil. Yay! Hey! All right. And thanks to our listeners. Be safe and
be legal!
You've been listening to the award-winning Legal News and Review, recognized by the Florida Bar's Award of Excellence. To contact the legal panel hosts and guests, go to belegalbuzz.com. And to reach Gary Singer, board-certified real estate and syndicated columnist, appearing in 400 media outlets, including the front page of the Money Section every Monday in the Sun Sentinel, from the law firm of Gary M. Singer, PA, call 954-851-1448. For legal news and review, remember, be legal.